This is Speaking of Purpose, where we talk to real people making real change. Today, I am overjoyed to bring you a real person that I get to work with every day. In this episode, we're sitting down with Benevity's new CEO, Soraya Alexander. Soraya is one of those rare corporate executives who has spent almost the entirety of her career in the social impact space.
It's not actually purpose versus profit. One feeds the other. If you really believe in what you're building, you need a company that can grow because you want to do more of that goodness in the world.
She has seen purpose from almost every single angle with nonprofits during her time at Classy, activating consumer fundraising at GoFundMe, and now at the helm of Benevity, the leading corporate purpose platform.
We are part of a system. You get to choose what to do with that. And that is a really lucky thing. I find it really invigorating. And if you find it overwhelming, take a small action. That's great. But you're part of it whether you want to be or not. It's an invitation and a little bit of an expectation that you take that seriously.
In this conversation, we'll get to know the real woman behind the big title and the enviable career. Soraya, welcome to Speaking of Purpose.
I am so happy to be here. Longtime listener, first time caller. So thanks for having me, Soda.
So as I mentioned in my introduction, Soraya, you joined Benevity as CEO literally just days ago. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to tell us the story of how this came to be and the career journey that got you landing right with us, where many of us Benevityites feel like you belong.
I feel like I belong here as well already. It's been the most amazing transition. And as you mentioned, I am brand new to being in role kind of officially, but I've been slowly ramping behind the scenes for a few months now. The story of how this came to be is a little bit funny. It started about a year ago. So as you mentioned, I've been with Classy for several years. We support nonprofits in their fundraising. It was with GoFundMe. Many of you no GoFundMe, have given to GoFundMe campaigns. And we have followed Benevity largely because of the work that you've been doing, Sona, and just this real voice around what does corporate purpose mean and how do corporations, you know, with strong morals show up and engage their employees and their communities. And so we've always kind of looked to you. And about a year ago, a very old friend, Chris Maloof, stepped into the CEO role completely randomly. And I called him and I said, what are you doing in my space? I am so happy to have you here. How can I help? Let me get you plugged into everything. I want to hear what's on your mind. I'll share what's on my mind because we're all in this work together and I would just love to partner. And so over the past year, we would talk, you know, pretty regularly about things that we were seeing, about things that were exciting, about challenges that our clients were facing. And it's been a really wonderful, I think, partnership and friendship. And I decided kind of earlier this summer that I think my journey with GoFundMe was coming to an end. I had done so much of what I wanted to achieve and I was ready for a next challenge. And when I said that I was leaving, Chris was one of the first people to call me. And he said, you're out on the market. I want you to come and work with me more closely at Benevity. Do you want to be an advisor? I want you to talk to the board. Like, what are you interested in doing? And the true story is I told him, I kind of want your job. Like, you don't love what you're doing as much as I'm going to love what you're doing, which isn't a fair thing to say, but I really felt it in my bones. And he paused for a second, as Chris does. And he said, all right, give me a night. Let me go, like, think about this. Let me talk to some people. And it built from there. And I'm so happy that I did it because it's been just an amazing, you know, early journey.
That's an amazing story. I love it. I think that It's actually such a great example for so many women, especially, but men as well. You know, teaching them that actually by putting out what you want into the world, you increase the chances exponentially that it'll actually happen. And so I love that story. And, you know, kudos to Chris as well for having the humility to kind of say, actually, I think this is a really good decision and we can continue this partnership in a different way. So I don't know. I really feel like that's so much of what we need to see in the world, where people are willing to work together to find new models of how we can lead through this time.
He's been an amazing partner. And I think through all of it, our private conversations, which happen very, very, very frequently, are always, how do we support the company through this? And how do we support our clients through this? And that sounds like something I'll just say on a podcast, but it actually is what defines every single thing that we are doing? Who's the right person to kind of lean in here? How do I step back? How do I support? What's the right way that we can partner to make sure that everybody feels like they can do the best work of their lives, whether at Benevity or through our clients? And I really have valued that even in these initial months.
Well, and I think I can honestly say to you, Soraya, that so many of us at Benevity are excited, but I know you've already been out meeting with clients, meeting with some nonprofit partners. And I think I can also speak on their behalf to say that they're quite excited for this next incarnation of Benevity. I'd love to hear a bit more about the career journey that you took to land here at Benevity, because like I mentioned, you've had a pretty enviable career, and so many people are always trying to get into the social impact space, but you've spent almost the entirety of your career in the social impact space. So I'd love to just hear a bit about that journey and maybe what you've carried forward with you, you know, as you've moved from company to company.
Yeah, journeys only make sense in hindsight. I think as anybody who's had a little bit of a career knows that you look and you say, oh, it's been this amazing package and you've been building to this kind of pinnacle point, and there's this, like, you know, opus of work, and it honestly is so random when you go through it. I think anybody can, most people agree with that. I really wanted to start and build my career in social impact. Right after college, I went to Washington, D.C. I'm based in the United States, and I wanted to work on the causes that kind of called my heart. And so even in college, I worked at Amnesty International for a while in their refugee department. I went and worked for a firm that supported a bunch of large international, national foundations, nonprofits, doing advocacy work, doing digital strategy, and helping on their, like, communications. How do we win hearts and minds of people who need to understand the work that we're doing? And I got hired by one of our clients at PBS to kind of further build out, like, how do you activate people who should know about us? How do you get into the minds of consumers or viewers or supporters who should be really engaged by our content and maybe just don't know? So that's always been the question of, like, people want to find themselves in something bigger than themselves, and they don't always know exactly how to do it. So that's been a lot of my work. I actually ended up going to business school and taking a little, like, you know, I circumvented the social space for a minute. I went into media, and then I went into retail, actually just to keep doing that. What wins hearts and minds? It was a lot of customer loyalty work, a lot of marketing work, a lot of e-commerce work, a lot of digital strategy, a lot of systems work. And so it was that intersection of engagement and technology, and suddenly found Klassi, which was kind of the intersection of all of it. It is e-commerce and loyalty and winning hearts and minds for the space that always had my heart. And it was such an amazing opportunity. But through my roles at Klassi, it was, how do you build a company in service of something bigger? So there had been a lot of nonprofit work where you're just about, you know, quote, just about the mission. And then your retail, where you can have a mission-driven company, but at the end of the day, you know, you're trying to sell something. And then to find a company that actually the only way that we succeed is by helping activate more goodness in the world. But you have, like, profit is the way that we measure our success against that bigger mission. And how do those things get integrated? It's not actually purpose versus profit. One feeds the other. If you really believe in what you're building, you need a company that can grow because you want to do more of that goodness in the world. And that's the measure of how you're succeeding. And I think that Klassi training ground of building a really successful company in service of supporting billions of dollars of good, it taught me so much that I've carried forward. And then, you know, we got to carry that to GoFundMe. And now I'm excited to kind of continue that journey with all the Benevityites I get to work with.
Yeah, I remember encountering the Klassi brand for the first time, where you used to, and I don't know if it still do, host a conference called The Collaborative.
Yeah,
it's this. Yeah. It was incredible. It was this giant, like, warehouse in Boston, where I showed up, and it was food trucks for lunch, but it was like, it was a, like, the ground where you could feel that things were going to happen, where the world could possibly change. And I remember it had such a deep impression on me. It was early on in my time in the social impact space. And I think even just the name of it, The Collaborative, has stayed with me consistently. So sorry, I have to say, like, I think maybe you were behind some of that.
We loved the Boston. That was the seaport, and it was not designed to be a conference space, I will say. We had to have all kinds of sound mufflers because it was just a giant warehouse. And we had, you know, a couple thousand people there trying to think about doing good in different ways. But you had to get creative on how you made that happen. I'm so glad it made an impression.
Now that you say that, I remember they had to bring in all these air conditioners because it was too cold.
All that. You are being generous. They were just giant fans. It wasn't actually even air conditioning, but you do what you have to do to get the right conversations happening. We just were not about perfection. It's about progress, right? And we tried to live that.
I'm curious about what it is that you think might have led to that personal sense of purpose for you. Was there something earlier before, you know, school or before your career that you think might have shaped this journey?
I have been asked this question before, and I've never had an answer that feels like it captures it. And I believe the reason is that it is almost too core to be able to name. I'll say, you know, I'm half Persian, I'm half Greek. I was born in England. We moved to the United States when I was small. We spend a lot of time internationally. We still have a lot of family who lives around the world. I'm really lucky because of that. But it also has put me very close to a lot of other lives I could have lived. And they're all, luckily, wonderful, parallel, alternative universe lives. But I think because of that, I understand how random my current journey is. Like, there's nothing special or deserved about where I am. It is just a wild gift, and just such a random gift. And I think carrying that really closely, there's a sense of, okay, so I've been given this gift. Like, how do I express gratitude for it? The word gratitude didn't come about until a book that you recommended for me, The Service Fairy, which I read and I loved. And the author captured it in this way, which is like, my action and the ways that I give back to the world are my expression of gratitude for everything I've been given. And that was the first time I read it that I said, yes, this is it. Because I'm wildly grateful. And so what else would I do with my time other than try to make this like beautiful world we live in a little bit better for those who, you know, don't have it as easy? Like, why am I where I am? No reason at all. And so I'm aware of that. And I try to use that time and like privilege a little bit thoughtfully.
Yeah, it reminds me, I think it was Bono who said, you know, where you're born is just the luck of longitude and latitude.
But yeah.
Yeah, but boy, does it ever shape the outcomes in your life. Like, you can be born, like, just from where you're born can completely almost determine, you know, a majority of your destiny in a way. And so I think that I really relate to that because my parents are immigrants into Canada as well. And I think had I been born and raised in India, I think my life would be so, so, so different. Not good or bad ways, just different. And
yes.
Yeah, you know, especially in your mind.
Yes, yeah, exactly. 100%. And I do think, you know, if we're talking about where we were raised, there's also how we were raised, no matter where that is. And I'm really grateful because my parents were never particularly impressed with things or with title. They were always talking about people who had done amazing things for their community. They would talk a lot about like goodness. And they weren't trying to hit us on the head with it. It was just the things that they admired. And you absorb a lot from your parents. And so those were the virtues that I would admire. You know, it was thoughtfulness. It was actually intelligence. And like, are you trying to be a critical thinker? Are you really engaging with things? And are you trying to be somebody who makes the world better? And I, you know, I didn't always give them a lot of credit for that, but I, again, grateful that that was the household I was raised in.
Yeah. Yeah. You realize how kind of deeply influential those values are and how much they're inherited. And especially as you get older, thinking about, there's this, I don't know if you found this, Sarai, but there's this point in your life where you start to think about what is really me and what is just inherited and how do I actually tease those apart and start to live authentically who I am versus the social familial conditioning. And but that to me sounds like one that, like, in some cases, the conditioning is really a gift to the world as well.
I'm hoping that the conditioning is the real me. And if it's not, I don't want to know. Like, I appreciate that that's how I've been conditioned. So I'll hold on to it regardless.
I love the way you think about, you know, what your parents prized. As we think about, you know, the world today a little bit, maybe this is a bit tangential, but I just kind of want to go there, is it sounds like they prized some really valuable character traits. When you think about translating that into heroes, are there people who you really look up to and prize, especially now?
There's so many, but they're not necessarily the big names. I mean, I can find big names that I really prize. It's always the people. Again, you said tangential, so I'll go tangential. Warren Buffett had a quote on how he hires, and he said, let me think if I get this right. He said, I look for intelligence, energy, and integrity. And if you don't have the third one, forget it, because the first two without the third one can be really dangerous. And I think the people that I've really respected in my personal life or in the world are people with intelligence, energy, and integrity, and just the ability to have impact in the most micro or the most macro ways, you know. And so I think about old mentors, or you know, my old Girl Scout troop leader, or I go back to my parents, you know, as people that I just consistently are doing the things that they say they believe in. They just stand behind that. There's just very little gap in what they say and what they consistently do. And so it's people like that. And then there's some people that just have an impact. I was so lucky very, very early in my career. One of my clients was the Nobel Women's Initiative. It's all the women who had won the Nobel Peace Prize, which when you're 21, to be able to, you know, have any FaceTime with those women will make an impression. And I'll never forget, I met Wangari Maathai, and who's, you know, since passed away, but she would walk into a room and it felt like just the air would stop. Like just there was an energy of kind radiance and calm and compassion that would come through. And I don't know how to describe it unless you can read about it, but sometimes you just have to actually experience it. And you know, there's people like that who make an impression on you that you will just carry through your life. Like you don't need the loudest voice. You don't need to try to impress people. You can just be confident in like the values you hold. And that is actually enough. Like that is it. That is it. That's all there is. And that kind of consistency and presence like really made an impact on me. And I think ways, again, I don't know that I totally have words for.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's making me think that we probably have so many more heroes than we actually give credit to on a day-to-day basis. And at times like this where things feel tough, it's actually worthwhile really thinking about all those people and just holding space for that, because that it's such good energy. It's
Yeah. Well, it's the same way I think, you know, you say at the end of your life, who will you wish you had spent more time with? And it's not the biggest names in the world. It's your kids and your parents. And it's the same, you know, is why it's because the people you love and also the people you really respect because you know them so closely and you just see that consistency and richness. And I, you know, try to appreciate that now as much as I can.
Yeah. So that was okay. We did go off on a bit of a tangent going on, but that's okay. I think we're gonna do a few of those. But let's come back to your career at GoFundMe. You were COO, and in that role, you helped 190 million people raise more than $40 billion. That scale is incredible, like almost unfathomable. Like they just start to become numbers. But really curious about what lessons about generosity that you might have learned there, that you continue to think about and want to instill in what you do next.
There is we had this expression around unlocking generosity, because what we found is people deeply care about certain things. Anytime you have a conversation with somebody, you will find the thing that gets them. You know, like, oh, I love my dog. I can't imagine, you know, all these dogs sitting in shelters, or the idea of kids without access to great education is wildly painful, or I have lost somebody to cancer, and I hope there's a day when nobody has to experience that. Everybody has, there's things that carry that make them human. Like that's just what the life experience looks like. That's just what the human condition looks like. You are faced with different kinds of pain and, you know, that calls to you. And yet there is this gap between the things I care about and my sense of agency to do anything about it. And we spend a lot of time in that space in between. What actually gets somebody from caring to action? And how do we make those two sides of, you know, caring to action come really close together to the point of convergence? And that is actually a hard thing to solve, even though it should feel like the easiest thing to solve. And I will say, when you solve it, when you actually get somebody to say, you know what, I'm going to make a donation or I'm going to volunteer, by and large, people will report that's one of the most fulfilling moments of their lives. That is a huge dopamine hit. They feel fulfilled. They feel connected. They feel like, you know, oh my God, I am part of something bigger. And yet donor retention stays really low and new donor acquisition is really hard. And so like, how do you grapple with all of that in a way that helps people find agency in the things they care about? So over the years, you know, we spend a lot of time saying, okay, when your neighbor needs help, you show up. A lot of what GoFundMe is your immediate social circles. And when somebody in your circle needs help, you show up in these amazing, incredible ways and very consistently. And GoFundMe was a lot of small moments of the human experience where communities are showing up for each other. Well, guess what? All those communities have now been touched by something. How do you introduce them to the nonprofits, the organizations working at scale on that issue? And how do you give them tools to show up as a collective? Like, do we have that? A lot of the time, you know, you will donate to something as a way to raise your hand and say, I want to participate. I want to be part of the solution. And, you know, I've spoken about this before, but like, you get a tax receipt. How uninspiring. I was trying to find my people and I got a tax receipt and now I'm going to be marketed to for, you know, for time or like, that wasn't it. But it's hard to create experiences where suddenly I'm like, oh, did you know my neighbor also cares about this cause? We're going to show up in partnership for something bigger than ourselves. I think there's a real human desire to do that, but we don't necessarily have the mechanisms or the tool or the technology or, you know, something to facilitate that. So almost all of our time was spent trying to solve this problem. And to your point, there was a lot of ways that we succeeded, $40 billion worth of success. And we actually think it's just a drop in the bucket of what the generosity potential looks like.
Yeah. Wow. And I mean, I can imagine just that is, it's motivating the little bit that you do unlock, but all the potential to unlock is just deeply motivating.
For any, like anybody that's been on an e-commerce site, how many times have you gone to a page and said, like, do I want the shoes? Do I not want the shoes? Conversion rates on those pages from like you click on the page all the way to your cart to checkout are not 100%. At some point, you'll be like, oh, my credit card. I don't feel like getting the shoes. I'm not sure. I'll sit on it. I'll do it later. That's fine for shoes. To find your cause, to find World Central Kitchen and say, I actually really care about this crisis, all the way to the point of I'm going to get to a donation page and then not convert. Oh my gosh, like that would terrorize us, you know? Like, no, we need to solve this problem. And you know, it's just like a really, I think it makes it real. Like, why aren't conversion rates 100% on donation pages? Like, you have shown you're interested. So anyways, back to your question, but these are the things that we would agonize over.
I love that. But it literally is any bit of friction, both in the human or in the system,
yes,
can actually have a material difference, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So you talked a lot about connections and community. Like, those are really the resounding themes. I'm hearing generosity as well. And you've clearly got deep kind of thoughtful experience from both the consumer and nonprofit perspective. I'd love to hear how you think, or already maybe know from your own experience, how that shows up differently in kind of company-driven purpose programs or in corporate spaces.
Yes. Well, and I recognize that I'm speaking to an expert about corporate philanthropy and I am still new. So I will say things and I will learn a lot more. And in a year, we'll laugh over a drink about how wrong I got it. At this moment in time, I will say that, you know, there's a lot of conversation research around this concept of third space. So your first space is your family, you know, your immediate ties to your family. Second spaces are often like your employer, like where do you go to work and how do you live and show up in those moments? And then there was all these third spaces, which are really about like communities, your neighborhoods, your religious institutions, your Rotary Club, like the places that you would show up just as a person in larger community. Those are really falling off. Like, we don't have as many as we did even a decade ago. Membership to these, you know, these institutions are dropping. People don't join Kiwanis and Rotary Clubs and local, you know, communities and religious institutions, like that's, you know, there's declining attendance. So where are people finding their communities? They're actually often finding it through work. If you think about the ERG programs, if you think about the ways that we get together to, you know, volunteer, you're trying, you really feel a kinship. There's so much time that you spend in work. There's so much, often, if you're lucky, agency you have to kind of choose the people and the ways that you want to work. That has become a little bit of a replacement. So as we think about how do you express the things that matter to you, actually work is one of the key places that we can kind of figure this out. And you think about the largest concentrations of like financial capital and human capital, and also how people want to, you know, show up as their true selves. It's such a logical place for community to thrive. And if I think generosity is deeply tied, which I do, generosity is deeply tied to your sense of belonging in these communities, this is a large part of the answer to unlocking more of that generosity. And so when I was, you know, had gone through all of, you know, the years of Classy and then with GoFundMe, it was like, how do I actually solve this problem in an even more specific way? You get to, you know, my conversation with Chris asking for his job a few months ago.
But it makes a lot of sense, right? And I'm just reflecting. I mean, I'm 48 now, so like I'm definitely on the older generation of the workforce. And what I find is, you know, there's the, like, as I even walk through the halls of Benevity or when we're visiting clients, the amount of people who actually their social circles and their coworker circles, like the Venn diagram, is really overlapped. Because to your point, I think with like just the proliferation of all these digital communities, the most in-person community is the one at work. The other thing I think that's so interesting about that is like we're talking a lot about community, which tends to be tied to shared values, beliefs, and identity. But the other really cool thing about corporate spaces is they are probably the most diverse spaces we will find ourselves in, because these are not people we chose. And typically we choose people like us to hang out with. And so, you know, people from different economic strata, people from different lived experience backgrounds, from different cultures, different countries, different, like, especially if you're working in multinationals. And so I think the opportunity for both community and diversity in those spaces, and yet finding shared belonging between, for example, a refugee and an Indigenous person. Like I just experienced that at an event that we had at Benevity where a bunch of us went out to a ranch and we were working with an Indigenous led or like an Indigenous focused organization. And there were Indigenous elders there. We started talking about places that are special to us. And for those of us who come from immigrant parents or are refugees, the sense of home and, you know, and where we are is really strong. And then you talk to these Indigenous folks and the place of land and home and connection is, and you start to see these shared values across lines that you think make you different, but actually don't.
Mm-hmm. I had never actually thought about that. It's such a important point of, it's been talked about so much of, you know, your echo chamber is getting smaller and smaller and more curated to the point that you really never have to face anything that you don't want to, that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. And work is almost one of the last bastions of that in a really healthy way. You're all trying to build something together and you get to work with people who you don't interact with. And what a beautiful opportunity to be exposed and challenged and kind of have the opportunity to grow as a human. I had not thought about that. Like I said, I'm coming in new and you're going to expand my thinking on this, but I think that's absolutely right.
I feel like we've talked a lot about themes that are very human-centered. So I'd love to raise AI. It's the thing that's on everyone's brains. How do you think AI will affect our space and maybe our civil society?
It's a tough one. And the answer can go in a lot of ways as well. I think on the one hand, right now, I am hearing way more conversations around like, what does it mean to be human? And how do I hold on to the things that are most important and beautiful about humanity in a way that I don't remember ever talking about? You never had to be intentional about humanity or being human because it just was. And now suddenly we're saying, what does it mean? And I think these conversations around real connection, brain forward morality are coming up more and more. Like, I don't want to outsource those decisions around what I care about and how I show up for those things and how I show up for the community and how I show up around the things that are important to me. And I don't ever remember talking about it as much as we are talking about it now. So that's a glimmer of hope that hopefully intentionality then drives kind of behavior and we care for it in a world where everything's changing. I also think that people are very nervous right now and they're trying to figure out, like, where do I sit? How do I even navigate changes that I've never, I can't even contemplate. And again, in those moments, you can either retrench or you can lean into what makes you human. You know, we saw it in COVID that people were very scared. They had not faced something like this before. And you saw this overwhelming outpouring of, we are here for each other in this really beautiful way. And I think if we're talking about some of the organizations that we're trying to support and show up for, the kinds of advances you can see in actual, like, access to education or advances in science to cure some of these diseases, like, it's an amazing thing as well. There's amazing unlocks on the horizon. And suddenly your ability to show up for causes that are important to you and feel like you can actually make a difference and see the difference. It's not decades away and you're contributing in some small way to fundamental research. Like, no, you might be able to contribute and then feel like you can see the end of, you know, the curing of cancer. Like, that's incredible. And a lot of organizations are trying to say, like, no, your dollars make impact. And suddenly that impact might be accelerated in certain areas. But we work with, you know, big corporate clients. And I think a lot of their workforces are saying, what does it mean to be part of this workforce in this moment? And this is a real opportunity that connects people inside an organization. When you're facing a lot of change, what keeps you motivated and unified and kind of tied to your bigger kind of corporate goals? And you have led a lot of this research that says some of these moments around kind of purpose at work remind people that we are all here together. We are all here as humans. We are trying to build something bigger. And so regardless of what you're building, AI products, products that are accelerated by AI, products that are disrupted by AI, whatever the bigger purpose is, AI is an enabler of it. And I think through that, these purpose at work programs have, like, a really important role to play. So it's a couple of different ways that they think about it. And then, of course, like, we're technologists. And so I'm wildly excited about the ability to bring forward technology powered by AI that helps better activate people. You have all of these small communities that you should know about in your workforce already. How do you find the peers? You were saying that all these people who don't look like you, you're not as familiar with, they have different cultural backgrounds, different economic backgrounds, but there's actually my community in here who all care about the same things. Can I use some of these AI forward tools to enable better, faster, more scalable connection? Amazing. And we're definitely building those things right now. So that's pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, I think that potential to drive kind of relevancy in helping you discover the people or the organizations or the communities, and you know, the way you've been talking about it, could be really powerful. And so if it could be used for that connection, then I'm all for it. I loved what you said about being intentional about our humanity. I've absolutely experienced that, where it's almost like we're, you know, I mean, both of us have marketing backgrounds. It's like, how do we differentiate from the robot? Like, how do we, right? Like, what's our differentiation? Because it feels like we're competing for jobs, right? And it's like, okay, what makes me better than AI? And I was, you know, kind of in my attempt to lean in, I did this course with Allison Taylor, who's, you know, a very well-known business ethicist and scholar and teacher at Stern. And she talked about, really, one of the responsibilities of companies is for them to help their people really develop the skills that only humans have: active listening, strong communication, critical thinking, and, like, how important actually enhancing the human skills are, so that we can harness the power of the technology in the ways that will advance society.
I'm laughing because earlier today, I happened to have my parent-teacher conferences, and my kids are in kindergarten and second grade. And all of the things you just said are the things that are, like, core that they're working on in kindergarten. And I'm like, no, still, it's still the thing. Like, active listening and critical thinking and communication and being a kind friend. Like, literally, we just discussed this. So I am full circle today, and I agree wholeheartedly.
It's a lifelong journey. Your performance reviews and court report cards are not that different.
They're really not. This is great. And at the end of the day, fundamentally, you apply those principles in whatever scale of complexity and challenge that you're trying to go for. And, you know, we're not actually as evolved as we sometimes think we are. From my 5-year-old.
Truth. You know, I mentioned this earlier, Soraya. You've been on a bit of a tour already, meeting with clients and nonprofit partners and other partners out in the ecosystem. You've been onboarding at Benevity, meeting a bunch of Benevityites as well. If you can, I would love for you to share, like, what are you hearing about purpose and intent and momentum for other leaders in this moment?
So this is I'll give you my honest answer. And it's not the answer that is the nice billboard. But I know that this is a podcast about being real. And so I will be real. I came in with a real bias towards figuring out, you know, what is the core, you know, North Star job to be done? Our clients are coming in to have outsized impact, to engage their employees in really high, you know, with really high participatory activations. They want to be able to prove business value through their programs. And all of those things are still very much true. And I came in with a sense of, oh, if we can, you know, double down on our ability to accelerate those capabilities, how amazing. Your North Star goal is going to be my North Star goal. And we're going to orient the whole company around driving whatever it is, impact higher, engagement higher. And those things are true. And there's a big asterisk with pretty much every single person I have spoken to, which is in this moment in time, we also just want permission to keep doing the work. And so maybe we're not actually trying to set the world on fire in terms of wildly higher numbers. Right now, we need to protect these programs because they are being positioned in ways that go so far outside of the intent of them. And that is a scary place to be when you're trying to really do good, thoughtful, community advancing work, to suddenly feel like I've got to look over my shoulder because I could, you know, be tripped up in any moment. It could be taken out of context and become a liability. There's a real sense of like, we need partners who can understand that. And so a lot of our conversations, even in our early, you know, executive conversations around how do we make sure that we're always very thoughtful, very consistent, you know, highly reliable partners in making sure that these programs are just inscrutable. And that is a hard thing when everything is under scrutiny. And so that's the sentiment I've gotten, which, you know, I do think is different than it was 5 years ago. And I think we can be both things. We can drive engagement. We can build programs that drive even more impact. And we can do it in a way that you feel really confident about. And we know that, you know, we're there as partners through it. But I do think it's a moment in time that we are navigating.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is probably the biggest shift in sentiment I have seen. I think that, even just a year or 2 years ago, the biggest enemy of these programs was ineffectiveness, like just maybe low participation or an inability to really communicate your impact or your outcomes. And all of that is kind of true, except now the biggest enemy of these programs is potential liability and reputational risk. And it's just, it's a completely different mindset on these programs. And the feeling of having to protect the impact or protect the culture. But I think, you know, it goes back to what you were saying right at the very beginning, I think, Soraya, around we need these communities as humans. Like, we actually need them. We're hardwired for this. Everyone wants to feel a part of something, and so something bigger. And so strangely, we're having to protect the things that we know are core to being human, and all of us are humans at work.
Yeah. And I will say that we're having to protect them, but it's not because there's actually a desire to take them away. There's a desire to make sure they are protected so that the work can continue, because actually the commitment is still there. It's still very, very high. It's been really steadfast. It's just make sure that we can continue to, you know, defend these programs. Your research has been leading this. The participation has remained very consistent, and companies are still doing this work, which is really heartening. Like, they're doing it in slightly different ways. The importance of, you know, really being inscrutable is higher, but the work is still being done. And I think you're right that at the end of the day, people want to know that they're part of something bigger. People want to be good people. They want to do things that comport to like that vision of themselves. And so, you know, the work isn't going anywhere, which is, you know, also something to keep in mind. Like, don't get overly caught up in this moment. This, you know, this work has been here. It will continue to be here. And we need to do it in a particular way right now. But also, you know, don't get too worried. Like, it's here. We're here for the long run.
Yeah. You know, I find speaking with nonprofit partners, especially organizations that have been in civil rights movements, really refreshing, because they're like, we have always experienced pendulum swings on rights. But we have made progress in 40 years, for example, on gay and lesbian rights, or on like even just racial equality, gender equality. We have made progress. So I always think about that long-term view of and people who've been in those fight, I find them so inspiring because they are so calm, because they're like, we've done this. We can do this. We know how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yes.
One thing that I have learned about you in the short time that you and I have worked together is you're someone who likes to have fun.
You try? Which you're?
I have, yep. No, it's about business, but you really have a lot of fun doing it. And so I want to have fun for just a minute with some, we're going to do a lightning round. So some rapid fire questions. And don't worry, I'm going to start really easy. And we'll get a little more advanced, but the idea here, though, is kind of just what comes to mind. Okay.
Great.
Ready?
Okay. Ready.
Okay. Cats or dogs?
Cats. And I have one of each. So don't, you know, earmuffs on my puppy.
Okay. Katy Perry or Taylor Swift?
Taylor Swift.
Your personal anthem?
Good Day by the Nappy Roots. It's such a great song.
Okay, the book everyone has to read.
Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
One fad you would like to see come back.
The long sweaters with leggings underneath them.
the coziest Boston winters I had. This is someone from San Diego saying this. Okay. Who would you want to be stuck in an elevator with?
The first thing that came to mind is my grandfather. My grandfather, who I will say lived through World War II in Greece during the occupation. And when I was getting married, which I think is applicable to all, you know, a lot of relationships, he said, you know, while you're still kind of shopping around, eyes wide open. When you commit, eyes half closed. It was just a sense of like, you give grace to people. Give grace to people in your lives. And a wild, wicked, ruthless sense of humor. I'll stay in the elevator with him all day.
Well, I love that. You'd get it all.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, and you don't have to take this literally, but who should run for president?
Pete Buttigieg, but, you know, I don't know if our country's ready for it. Or Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama. Again, if reality is not an obstacle, I'll go with her.
Last question. Pretend it's December 31st. What's your one word for the next year?
Momentum. As somebody who is really type A, I'm going to think about this all night and come back at 2 a.m. say, Sona, we got to re-record. I found a better word. So I'm saying it. And the need to just like have that as my final answer is going to weigh on me for weeks. So we'll just acknowledge that as well.
I'm sorry. But I have a sense that other things will soon occupy your mind, Soraya.
I mean, that might be true.
Okay, so we're almost at the end here. And we ask all of our guests the same last question, which is, of course, as you know, this podcast is called Speaking of Purpose. And so we really want to give you the last word, Soraya. What about purpose needs to be said right now?
Anybody listening to your podcast is in such a lucky place. And I know that people are listening from all walks of life. I don't actually care where you are. We are so lucky. And there is so much you can give. And we are part of a bigger ecosystem, whether we want to be or not. We are part of a system, and you get to choose what to do with that. And that is a really lucky thing. I find it really invigorating. And if you find it overwhelming, take a small action, and that's great. But you're part of it whether you want to be or not. And so it's an invitation and a little bit of an expectation that you take that seriously.
Giving orders.
Day one, here we go.
Thank you so much for joining, Saraya. We're looking forward to having you on board what we call the rocket ship at Benevity. And let's go to the moon together. Well, let's not really go to the moon together.
No. We got enough work to do here. Let's stay here and do all the great things here. Soda, thank you so much.